And thank you to the people who are here listening. It's been a very creative and enjoyable discussion, not just presentations, but ideas about how to solve things. First of all, it was great to hear this morning a contemplative presentation. I might call it a sermon about creation care. I haven't heard one of those in a while, and that was wonderful. And I think it probably brings us closer to where we need to be. I've also been thinking about this idea of prophecy, which is one of the callings of Christians, which is the idea that we are to speak truth into our culture. And I think that's part of what we're doing here. A little bit of prophecy is actually looking into the future or seeing things that other people don't see, because as our other speaker this morning noted, when we ask God to let us see, He oftentimes does allow us to see things. And in that vein, I am thinking that Leslie was talking about how some of the young people in her church are now, you know, we used to be lagging way behind the culture. Now we're catching up to the culture. But I have this prophetic vision that Christians really should be leading the culture, that our compassionate view of the world should be having us as the servant leaders for our society, in our universities, in our companies, in our communities. And so with that in mind, I'm presenting this very focused presentation. And of course, the answers are going to be focused. They're going to be specific to a particular location, a particular species, a particular problem. But they need to have a general underlying philosophy that we as Christians are prophetic, that we are allowed by God to participate in caring for His creation. So this is specifically about engineered reefs. And this is a problem that we have in Louisiana specifically due to two factors. One is that we are a sedimentary landform. We're at the delta of the Mississippi River. Most of southern Louisiana was formed by sediment deposited over the last several thousand years. And that sedimentary process has been limited by the levying of the Mississippi River over the last 200 years. And as the river was levied in, those sediments and the water with them have gone out and extended the land about 100 miles south, but the rest of the land is sort of shrinking away. Coupled with that, we now have a documented sea level rise. So you have a certain level of subsidence of the sediments and another amount. And I've been using the numbers 1 centimeter for each of those. The latest numbers that I read in the paper was a number of millimeters. But still, you're losing a little bit each year. And with a slope that is very flat, you lose this much, you lose that much. And so one possible thought is to approach this and say, how can we provide some solutions for this? I work in aquaculture, as Johnny mentioned, and so I'm very interested in the biological solutions. I originally did work on oysters, focused on them as a food product. I'm sure Jay and I could have a discussion on the way home on the ethics. Although, it is interesting, LSU has a ethics board, and non-vertebrates are exempt. So I can do all kinds of cruel things to oysters, and I don't have to report them. But as soon as I get to something with a backbone, when I do actual fin fish work, then I have to report that. So we have a great deal of coastal erosion. We also have the largest amount of coastal wetlands of any state in the United States. We have about 40% of the nation's coastal wetlands, but we have somewhere between 80 and 90% of the nation's coastal wetland loss. So it is a disproportionate loss. There are a variety of techniques already in place, some of which are pretty brute force. Army Corps is very good at piling up mud. We also have good civil engineering, structural engineering, coastal engineering, sort of wall building techniques for seawalls. Probably appropriate, you know, in a city type setting or for very localized areas, but probably inappropriate for a coast that's roughly 400 miles across. Cost prohibitive, as well as ecologically disruptive. So we came up with this idea of oyster breaks, which has a limited applicability, but I'll show you in a little bit. It's limited but quite broad applicability, where we provide some structure for these oysters to grow and then allow the oysters to do basically most of the work. And the biblical injunction that was also mentioned previously, the Genesis 2:15, amongst others, to Shamar and Abad, the Chicago police with their protect and serve, very similar mission. We hope we are doing as well as they are, maybe better. And of course, this idea of dominion, which someone I think suggested is more like parenting. I like that view. Here's some numbers, recent quotes, 100 square kilometers of loss per year. One of my grad students came to me and said, Dr. Hall, are you sure that's right? I did some calculations, and that's a football field every 30 seconds. And I said, oh yeah, that's the other number that gets quoted quite often. You did your math correctly. So 90%, 80% to 90% of the coastal wetland loss in the nation. And a probably highly undervalued ecosystem. Our coastal wetlands do a lot of things, including some of the reduction in the contaminants that come down, some of which make their way into the Gulf and produce this hypoxic zone where there's low oxygen. They also do some other things, like protecting major metropolitan areas, and one of the contributing factors to the impact on New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina was this significant reduction in the coastal wetlands between New Orleans and the ocean. The rule of thumb is 1 foot of reduction in ocean surge per mile of coastal wetland. Very rough number, but you can see how the loss of several miles of coastal wetlands would put the water up there instead of down here and could obviously have some significant impact. And then I like this idea of self-renewing. It's not only, I see it really in some ways in a sort of spiritual way, but certainly it's also economic and ecological as well. Here is one of many maps that have been created. The red parts are areas that have been lost or predicted to be lost in the near future. You will see that this extension where the Mississippi River comes down has in fact extended out from quite obviously where the historical edge of Louisiana was, by, like I say, somewhere in the range of 70 to 100 miles. The reason that it stopped extending is that this is the edge of the coastal plain and drops off into the deeper ocean here. Obviously, all of these areas are suffering as this loss of sediment that gets deposited out into the deep ocean is slowly sort of chewing things up in the Barataria Terrebonne basins. And this is predicted to extend further back in the near future. This is not a, someone was saying earlier, we don't want to overstate the case. This is a mid, this is not at all the extreme case. This is the sort of medium. It could turn out a little better than this. It could turn out a bit worse than this. This is probably about right. If sea level rise becomes worse, which is a possibility, then that map will, in fact, turn out to be worse. Here's some of the obvious causes. Sea level rise, roughly a centimeter per year. Land subsidence, roughly a centimeter per year. Again, somewhere in that range. Altered hydrology from the canals and levees, and then this reduced sediment input. In addition, you've got biological factors. Some of the plants are typically adapted to grow at certain salinities. Oysters also. Oysters prefer 15 to 25 parts per thousand. Pure seawater is 35, freshwater is 0. So they are an estuarine species. If you get too salty or too fresh, generally these species will not grow. Then the species are lost, and whatever holding power they have is further reduced. So there is a kind of negative feedback here, or I guess positive feedback in that sense. And then hurricane impacts are sort of just bonus. We occasionally have these giant storms as big as the Gulf of Mexico. Some of the traditional coastal structures are very, very physical structures, rocks, concrete. Seawalls and bulkheads would typically run parallel. Jetties oftentimes would run out into the ocean, thus reducing the longshore current and allowing some sediment to settle in behind the jetties. And breakwaters are another thing, which is usually an offshore but parallel to the ocean. I'll show you some pictures of these. These are some breakwaters that were constructed near Chenera Teague in southwest Louisiana, and we were there when they were being installed, and this is some construction since then. The Tombolo effect is the sedimentary effect that occurs, so this is the shoreline prior to these, and after a couple of years you'll get some buildup behind them. So this is a way of actually, and in the theme of Christians leading and not only reducing the rate at which, in this case, we are losing coastal wetlands, hopefully reversing the process, this is promising. Hey, maybe this is a way of actually adding a little bit of land in some localities. The problem with traditional breakwaters is that they are typically made of rock. Rock has to be brought in. It often has to be dredged because this is very shallow water. So you are impacting the environment pretty significantly, and it is a high energy cost, material cost, to bring these in. And with the coastal muds, when you put rocks down, over time, guess what rocks do when you put them in mud? Mm-hmm. And so you have to come back in a few years and do it again. Here's an example of this Tombolo effect, where you have sediment deposited behind the breakwater. It is a well-known effect, well-documented. Physical photographs pretty well prove this. Here is another example of a breakwater project, and this is a somewhat clarified picture, but it gives you an idea. And you can quantify also how much land has been added in different locations. There are a number of projects that are going on. QIPRA is the Coastal Wetlands Protection, Planning Protection and Restoration Act. Millions of dollars are being spent, not only in Louisiana, but other coastal areas, to do coastal restoration projects. Some of them are like this. Others are highly biologically oriented, but to try to reduce this problem. Again, some of the drawbacks are essentially you're impacting an ecosystem to protect it. And is there a way to reduce that impact? The mass of rocks, the cost, the transport, and then this upkeep. It's really a sort of unsustainable solution. It works money-wise with the current cost of fossil fuels. But if fuel costs go up to $5 or $10 a gallon, you will be doing far fewer of these costs, because a big part of them is, in fact, the heavy equipment, which is driven by the fuels. So a more sustainable solution was proposed. Basically, these are a kind of concrete, kind of special concrete rings. You can obviously make these in a variety of shapes. And they are made with some agricultural additives, biological additives that promote both the spat set, the settlement of the organisms onto this, and then the growth of the organisms. And over time, this growth essentially increases the stability of the structure, but also of the ecology and the hydrology around it. And most of these are dominated in the systems that we've used so far with the eastern oyster, Chrysostrea virginica. The oyster life cycle is something that you need to look at. Oysters are very interesting. This kind of understates the case. Adult oysters are male when they are young. And when they get big enough, they're female. When they're big enough to make eggs, then they become female. So typically the first year, oysters have an interesting life cycle. First year they'll be male, and they will send out the male gametes, the sperm, into the water. The second and succeeding years, they will be female. They'll send out eggs into the water. The eggs are fertilized in the water, go through stages to a veliger stage. At the veliger stage, there is a movement of the animal. So they're a mobile animal during the veliger stage. They set then at that point, and that's more or less in this stage when they're typically about a millimeter in size is when we typically find them or can see them, and then of course they grow, and once they are attached, they remain attached for life. They can attach to any hard substrate, including other oysters. So once you have a hard substrate, you will get more oysters, provided there is some spat set, and they are very, very fruitful. They will make hundreds of millions of reproductive cells in a season per animal, and they come by the billions, so there's plenty. And then it's really just a matter of is there a place for them and are the conditions appropriate for them to grow? Part of the question is where either do oysters currently exist or could they exist? And the answer is they could live a lot more places than where they do. With our sediments, a lot of places, there is no suitable habitat for them to settle on. And so this is sort of a jump start. Nature would eventually move them, and an earlier discussion talked about how the speed of some of the changes that we're going through now is quite fast, and will different species and ecosystems be able to adapt to that? This is a way of kind of helping an ecosystem. Sometimes we wrecked it. For a couple hundred years, we mined the oysters. Now we're trying to put them back. So, but probably a needed thing. We are also doing more diversions now, where you take part of the water out of the Mississippi and spill it with its sediment over into some of these areas that are losing land in order to add potential land material into that. As you do that, you are spilling fresh water. You're moving the fresh or intermediate water further south. And so that area where the oysters will want to grow will move. As that happens, you will again be in a location where you're going to want to jumpstart the process, and this is a way to do that. So this is not the only solution, but this is one possible solution. A previous student, Matt Campbell, made a structure. We tested it. It survived some tropical storms. Animals grew on it. A later student looked into the structures and the strengths of the concrete itself. There are patents on both of these. Then a series of reefs were designed and emplaced. The interlocking rings have become popular, and there are a series of projects, some Quipper project. There's also a Nature Conservancy project that's going in as we speak. There's a variety of these going on. Placement techniques. There are smaller versions of these and bigger versions of these. You're obviously going to do different things with these. Again, I am very interested in ways you can do these with less impact to the environment. So there's a series of techniques that a current grad student is working on to avoid the use of some of the really heavy equipment. But probably the most fundamental of these is that once they're in place, they will grow, and oysters can grow about 2 to 3 inches a year. And remember, our sinkage rate, our net sinkage rate, is somewhere in the range of 1 to 2 centimeters a year. So this thing sinks, but they can grow faster than that. And so this thing can stay ahead of the sinkage and also expand while simultaneously providing some habitat. So they provide habitat for juvenile fish. And in fact, that is one of the probably most valuable impacts of the reef systems and the coastal wetlands is for juvenile species. And probably one of the big losses that we have is that the marine species have less access to these locations as the coastal wetland loss occurs. And now, here I have this word progradation, just kind of quietly put in here. My grad student stuffed that in there. Shoreline progradation. Oh, that means we're actually gaining land. As it occurs, it will be important to utilize local plants. And so we're also interested in plants such as Spartina, mangroves. I know Spartina is the evil weed out west, but it's a native species here, so it's okay, not a bad thing. Avicennia germinans is the black mangrove. That's also native to Louisiana. But for different locations, it'll be different sets of plant and animal species. One more thing I'm going to mention, then hopefully I'll take some questions, is carbon sequestration. And I'm currently doing a study on carbon sequestration. I did not put the full biochemical relations on here. It turns out that the conversion of bicarb ions in the water to calcium carbonate actually produces one carbon dioxide on the right-hand side. So I ask you this question as the educator here. Are we, in fact, producing carbon and sending it up to the atmosphere and making global warming worse when we make these oyster reefs? And of course, it looks like it, and there's at least one publication out there that says evil oyster reefs, they make carbon. But then you sort of ask yourself, well, wait a minute. There's something that doesn't quite fit here, because you end up with these oysters, and we all know that they're about 12% by mass carbon, and you know that those things, they are indeed sinking slowly into the mud, and it's well documented that 50 feet down there are ancient oyster reefs that are down there. So you know that this has been happening for a while, and of course carbonaceous rocks lock up carbon for seemingly long periods of time. So what's really happening here? And the answer is, these are animals, not plants. So that's kind of the simple answer. Plants are known to sequester carbon directly. They take solar energy, take carbon out of the atmosphere, turn it into carbohydrates, and give off oxygen, toxic, evil oxygen, which we sort of think of as like kind of good from our perspective. We're animals, we do the reverse. We take the oxygen, we do some stuff, we spit out carbon dioxide. Oysters are animals. So yes, indeed, during their process, they do produce carbon dioxide. The question is not, do oysters produce carbon dioxide? The question is, what is the net effect? And since oysters are filter feeders, they feed on planktonic benthos, which is primarily plant matter, which is basically solar energy converted into carbohydrates. There will be a loss in efficiency, so this is not a 100% efficient process, but the net effect is, yes, indeed, you can sequester carbon, and then the question is, how much can you produce, and how fast will it grow? We've done some preliminary studies, and we're now deep into some specific studies to identify the numbers, nail them down a little bit better. Just to give you an idea, current projects are small, a few hundred feet up to about 2 miles for the Quipper project. So I don't know, maybe that's big, but it's not nearly as big as the Louisiana coast, which is, like I say, about 400 miles. So these are kind of little, you know, and plus the fact that that oyster zone extends, you know, in some places 20 miles across, 400 by 20. You can see how somebody gets to these big numbers of how fast you're losing. You want to reverse the process, you're going to have to do some big projects as well. So I did some kind of back-of-the-envelope calculations, and a very large reef, but a plausible reef, would be in the range of 10 miles or tens of miles. There is a proposed project around 9 miles that will likely happen in the next 2 or 3 years. And then you could imagine some beyond that. So I did a calculation of something that's 50 miles across by some modest thickness, and that amount could, based on some rough assumptions, accumulate about the amount of carbon that the state of Louisiana, not the country, but the state, produces from fossil fuels in a year. And it could do that on an annual, ongoing, sustainable basis. And in fact, it would probably increase slightly, because these oyster reefs not only grow up, they grow out. So it would actually slowly increase over time. So that's encouraging. I mean, it's not like this is going to solve all of our problems, but perhaps it will help. And then some of our current goals are, in fact, to create GIS maps that identify these locations, document construction and placement, evaluate growth specifically for some of these benefits, look at some of the physical aspects, wave energy reduction. In fact, oyster reefs are extremely good at dissipating wave energy, far, far better than any of the hard structures, which typically bounce a wave off. So a wave's coming in, it hits something hard, it bounces off, it doesn't kill whatever's behind there, but poor Margie over there, she's going to get smacked in the face, and her town's going to get real wet over there. Whereas an oyster reef will basically reduce that energy, allow some of the water to get beyond it, but with a dramatically reduced wave energy, and not reflect very much. So they're actually quite good, and we've documented that as well. And then the ecological benefits and the carbon sequestration. So obviously some of the pros are they're biological, they're porous, they're relatively low cost, about 85% less initial material, and then essentially no required additional material over time compared to many of the other things that require upkeep every few years. So these sound good. Some of the downsides, well, you can only grow these things where they'll grow, in this oyster zone, which is likely to shift over time, both downstream in some cases and upstream in other cases. You have additional initial materials, and you still are bringing something in and adding it there. And it takes space. You also have this kind of public opinion issue, and I have a little note about evangelicals in there. Ocean acidification is a very real phenomena, and it's looking to be 0.1 to perhaps 0.4 pH points. It doesn't sound like much. You know, you go like, well, yeah, like 7 is neutral, lemon juice is 3. Like, that's 4, and that's 4, it's 10 to the 4th. You know, so you're going, so 0.1, that's not bad. But it turns out people are very concerned about this because it will impact the calcium depositing capability of coral reefs, of oysters, of other species. And so that could have a big impact. And as you add carbon dioxide in aquaculture, we have very intense collections of animals. They make a lot of carbon dioxide, and the pH goes down a point or two, which is huge, and does all kinds of crazy things to water chemistry, and we know that. And we do things to kind of reduce that problem. The ocean's really big, so like it's not going to go down as much, but 0.3, 0.5 maybe pH units, that's actually a lot. And then you multiply that by giant, giant areas of reef, could be significant. Sediment and salinity issues. So, in summary, there are a variety of techniques that can be used. This is one of them. As Johnny noted, it's not just the scientific, it's the other aspects as well. And I think that, to say the least, challenges remain as we seek to protect and serve coastal communities and ecosystems. But I really do think this is the biblical imperative of our time. I mean, in many ways, this is our opportunity. For such a time as this, we have been placed here in our specific locations to do what we can do specifically to care for God's creation. So, you know, I really appreciate all of everyone else's presentations. Thank you for your time. If I get a minute or two for questions, that'd be great. I see Lynn. There is an entire discussion going on, and people are funny about words. Christians aren't the only ones who are funny about words. I like words like renewal or regeneration. I think that's a particularly Christian sort of term. Creation care, of course, is a great Christian term. People talk about restoration. So can you put it back just like it was, or can you put it back in a similar functional format to what it was? As an engineer, I'm more like a hockey player, I guess, wherever our hockey player speaker ended up. And I think we're going to have to be that way. We have impacted the coast. There's little doubt. It will never be exactly the same as it was. Can it be functionally restored to a healthy format? I hope so. And I think there's reason for some hope, yes.
Buckets full of oyster shells and polyester sort of mat things into which you zip tied the oysters.
Yeah.
And then she took these mats and anchored them in, and this was in Florida along the water coast.
Yeah.
So the problem is in the change in water levels so much as it is speedboats, which oysters don't get on.
Okay,
with.
Yeah.
And it would be a lot slower than yours, but it would have similar effects.
Yeah. Bill Deutsch used to do a water quality thing, which was a like outreach with people. And I think that's a great thing. If you can get a million people doing a little bit versus the federal government spending $100 million, you could really do something. It's very plausible that if you could get coastal community residents to pick up some of these ideas and do just small-scale things kind of to protect their little spot, you could actually have a positive impact. So
distribute these brick things to the town.
Yeah. And it's not really high tech. I mean, what I'm talking about is a very natural sort of process.
Time for one more question if there is any.
Okay,
now
next.
Let's thank our speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you.